Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Well, it's just you and me. We're going to dip into the archives in a little bit, and you'll know why later. Just trust me on this. I believe in the long form. But nothing new at the Art House Theater, but there are three films opening nationwide. Here you go. Palms, the film of a retirement community starting a cheerleading squad with Diane Keaton, Jackie Weaver, Rhea Perlman, Celia Watson, and Pam Grier. Also, Pokemon Detective Pikachu, voiced by Ryan Reynolds. And then we have The Hustle, a female version of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels with Anne Hathaway and Rebel Wilson. All of those are opening in theaters this weekend. Over at the Tibbs Drive-In on Screen 1, Pokemon Detective Pikachu and Ugly Dolls. On Screen 2, The Intruder and the Curse of La Llorona. On Screen 3, Avengers Endgame and Us. And on Screen 4, The Upside and Long Shot. All of those happening at the Tibbs. At the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville, you have Avengers Endgame and Ugly Dolls. Over at IU Cinema, Saturday, the 9.5 hour, well, a little less than that, documentary, The Human Condition starts at noon, will run through 9:30. But there will be a 45-minute intermission, 5 hours in the screening for a meal break. This is according to the IU Cinema website. Food truck service will be available outside the IU Cinema from 5:10 to 5:55. Not 5 to 6, 5:10 to 5:55. That's on Saturday, May 11th at noon with The Human Condition. Thursday the 16th, Celluloid Man from 2012 at 7 o'clock. Friday, May 17th, John McEnroe in The Realm of Perfection from 2018. That's at 7 o'clock on May 17th. Saturday, May 18th at noon, War and Peace from 1966, a new 4K restoration with a meal break with food trucks outside of IU Cinema from 4 to 4:45. That's a 7-hour film, folks. Well, less than 7 hours with the food break. And then Thursday, May 23rd, They Shall Not Grow Old in 3D. That's Thursday the 23rd, Friday the 24th at 7 p.m. at IU Cinema. At the Historic Art Craft Theater on May 10th and 11th at 2 and 7:30 p.m., The Wizard of Oz with a sing-along screening 2 o'clock on Saturday. That is happening over there. Friday and Saturday, May 17th and 18th at 2 and 7:30 p.m., Trading Places. On Friday and Saturday, May 24th and 25th, Grease at 2 and 7:30 p.m. There will be an interactive show of Grease on Saturday the 25th at 10:30 p.m. And then Friday, May 31st and Saturday, June 1st at 2 and 7:30 p.m., The Goonies. All of that happening at the Art Craft Theater in Franklin. New on DVD and Blu-ray this week, probably the big title is Lego Movie 2, the second part. I was surprised, as were a lot of people, about the first Lego movie. I thought it was going to be a 90-minute commercial. It turned out to be an hour and 40-minute smart film of use of Legos and Lego characters and being able to create whatever you want and not having to follow the fold. We're back with the second film. Not nearly as profound as the last one. It still looks cool, and most of the voices are back, which are still amusing. But I believe this time around the theme is learning to play well with others, and one does not have to be a good guy or a bad guy. Doesn't quite have the same effect as the last film. So it's kind of in that ballpark of Monsters University and The Incredibles 2. It's nice. It's not really, and it's not really necessary. So anyway, that is happening on DVD and Blu-ray. A couple of titles I want to talk to you about, also new on DVD and Blu-ray. From Film Movement Classics, there's a 2001 drama from Japan called All About Lily Choo Choo, and it's a series of teenage students all dealing with different types of angst in their world, all tied to the music by Lily Choo Choo. I don't know either, but it covers everything from bullying, online conversations, dealing with parents, dealing with each other, your own insecurities, the love of the music, what happens online, what happens at concerts. It's a lot of territory to cover. It's about almost 2.5 hours long. Maybe I was not in the right frame of mind or right mood. It could have been shorter for my taste, but it does tackle issues that are universal. It just so happens that this one is set in Japan. So it's a mature look at growing up and its hurdles, I should say. Probably just could have been a little tighter for my choice, for my taste. But I'm an old guy. What do I know? And new on new from Mill Creek Entertainment. This was a 2-CD set. For the most part, I think Mill Creek has the catalog from Columbia Pictures, but this is a thing called Cold War Thrillers, 2 DVDs, 6 films, 3 each, and they cover basically the spectrum of pretty good to decent. So what we have on this in this collection, starting with 1960s Man on a String, starring Ernest Borgnine, Colleen Dewhurst. Borgnine is a film producer, Hollywood film producer, recruited to be a counter spy for the American government to spy on the Russians. This is directed by Andre de Toth, who's best known for House of Wax, among others. A lot of Dragnet-esque clarification, voiceover to clarify things, to film-splain to us. Borgnine is pretty good. You also have, as a side note, you have a little couple of novelty early roles for Seymour Cassell as a waiter and Ted Knight as a teacher in an academy scene, which you'll notice. Probably the best film of the lot is from 1966 called The Deadly Affair, based on the novel by Jean Le Carré. And it's James Mason plays an agent who recently interviews a potential recruit, and that person commits suicide. So this follows after The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, where it's anti-James Bond, it's more down to earth, and in this case, what happens when a spy is riddled with guilt. And Mason trying to find out why this recruit committed suicide. Harry Andrews is also in it, as well as Lynn Redgrave in a small role. And what's interesting, and Maximilian Schell and Harriet Anderson, there's also a little love triangle between Mason's wife and the Maximilian Schell character, who was Mason's former protege. Roy Kinnear is also in this picture. What I didn't realize until I watched it, it was directed by Sidney Lumet, and one of my favorite directors, and there's still a handful of Sidney Lumet films I have not seen. This was one of them. It's there's a series of films from the mid-60s with Lumet that is not outstanding, but still pretty well done. There, probably the highlight of this film is a scene that happens in a performance of Edward II at the Royal Shakespeare Company. So Mason and Maximilian Schell and a few other people sitting in the theater waiting for the time to make a connection, and Mason is on the prowl. So the fact that we have this performance going on while we're waiting for somebody to arrive while a performance is happening in a crowded theater, the most tense moment of the film and the best scene from this collection. Besides it being directed by Sidney Lumet, this also has a very cool jazzy score from Quincy Jones and Arsenio Gilberto doing the theme song. So it was cool because it was, you know, Quincy Jones at this time was trying to do film scores for any type of film. So that was very, very cool. Also in this collection, from 1966, Otley, which has Tom Courtenay on a hot streak, fairly good hot streak in the 60s, as kind of a ne'er-do-well person who jumps from couch to couch, not necessarily for sex purposes, also for sleeping, who gets pulled in some political intrigue. It's fairly standard stuff. The man who knew too much, you know, a person pulled into a web that they know nothing about. But Tom Courtenay has a nice light touch to keep things moving, and he's the highlight of this film. My correction, that's from 1968, not from 1966. We also have A Dandy in Aspic from 1968. It stars Lawrence Harvey as, and this was the first R-rated film of this bunch, but it's where British and Russian intelligence agents are trying to outsmart one another, especially with a homesick double agent. Lawrence Harvey, Tom Courtenay back in this film, Mia Farrow's first film, Harry Andrews, Peter Cook, Lionel Stander, a lot of familiar faces. This was the first film for Calvin Lockhart. Quincy Jones also does the score. And yes, there is a credit of costumes for Mia Farrow and Harvey and Lawrence Harvey by Pierre Cardin. And this was the final film from producer-director Anthony Mann, who died during filming, and Harvey apparently finished shooting the film. But there's there's kind of a downward spiral for the Harvey character on who he can trust. Is he the target? It's a decent film from 1968. Also from 1968, Hammerhead, which stars Vince Edwards, Judy Geeson, for you fans of To Sir With Love. Peter Vaughn is in this, fairly young Peter Vaughn. What happens when an arts dealer or antique dealer gets pulled into some political intrigue? A lot of hippie scenes in this. This was a mainstream studio's attempt of representing the counterculture, which really fun. It really has a great moment in a silly climax involving a hippie beach party in England. A little dated. It's directed by David Miller, who later gave us Executive Action, Hail Hero, as well as the Kirk Douglas film Lonely Are the Brave and the John Wayne film Flying Tigers. Then we have The Executioner. Yeah, finally, this was the last from 1970 from Sam Wanamaker, George Peppard, Joan Collins, Judy Geeson back again, Charles Gray. Peppard is tracking down a spy who may be a double agent. Peppard doesn't think the agent is... Peppard thinks that the double agent is one of his bosses, and of course his bosses will have nothing to do with that. Also a love triangle involved in this. Not bad. A little dry at moments, but Peppard and as well as Geeson carry the film on this. So if you're into Cold War thrillers from the 1960s that are not The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, there is that collection. Okay, folks, we're going to dip into the archives to a 2011. Let me double check that. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Yes, I was right. We dip into the archives to a February 2011 interview I did with NPR's own Netta Ulaby. We're discussing the Academy Award nominations. And so anyway, hope you enjoy this. Joining me on Film Sociology, one of the voices of NPR and one of the first early supporters of this particular program, Netta Ulavy. How are you, Netta?
Hey, Matt. How you doing?
Doing fine. Doing fine. So let me ask, is there going to be an NPR party, or did the government cut the funding for that party, too?
Well, I am going to have a small, modest party at my house that is paid for by myself.
Oh, well, I guess whatever it takes. So let's be grown-ups. If there were five Best Picture nominees instead of 10, like it's a soccer tournament and everybody gets a trophy and a juice box, what would your five be?
Okay, I have to just qualify by saying I love small independent movies.
Sure.
I'm a big, big supporter of movies like Winter's Bone and The Fighter and The Kids Are All Right. Kids Are All Right was one of my favorite movies of the last year. But when it comes to Best Picture, I'm a little bit of a traditionalist. I like a big, epic movie where you can see every penny that has been put on screen. And, you know, a movie like The Hurt Locker, I would actually put right in that sort of big, epic tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Kitchen sink dramas, for me, not so much Best Picture. So my five would probably be Toy Story 3.
Okay.
The Social Network. True Grit. King's Speech, and then it would be a toss-up between The Fighter and 127 Hours, probably The Fighter.
Okay, I think I'm going with Inception, King's Speech, Social Network, Winter's Bone, True Grit.
Well, then between us, we've got them all covered, except for Black Swan. Did you say Black Swan?
I did see Black Swan, a very polarized, well, probably one of the most polarizing films this year, nominated and otherwise. I thought it was a great companion piece to Darren Aronofsky's last film, The Wrestler, and captured the world of the recycling world of ballet.
You know, it was a outrageous gothic horror movie, and those are not the type that tend to sweep up Oscars.
Afraid not.
I think Best Actress is pretty much the only category where that one has a serious shot, and I just would be really surprised if Natalie Portman wins it this time. She's got an amazing career, and there are going to be a lot more movies that I think she's going to win for. I don't think it's going to be this one, as fabulous as she was.
Well, and there's always that, if you look at Oscars past, there's that thing of being able to toss somebody a bone or career recognition. Do you think it's Annette Bening's year?
Well, I wouldn't call tossing it her a bone. I mean, that performance was incredible. And, you know, when you look at the sort of minimalism of that story, it was just, that was a kitchen sink drama. That was a family story where she didn't have fancy costumes or special effects. You know, she didn't even have makeup.
That's true.
And I thought that was the performance of the year. I absolutely did. It was a brave performance. She took me places that I didn't expect her to. You know, as wonderful as I thought Natalie Portman and indeed all the other best nominated actresses were, I wasn't surprised by anything that Natalie Portman did as an actress. She needed to be over the top. She was over the top. She needed to be skinny. She was skinny. Annette Bening, I didn't know what she was going to do. She was scary. She was filled with love. She was filled with rage. You didn't know what was coming, but it all made sense. It was all true.
And that was a film about a marriage, which we haven't really, well, except for Blue Valentine. But that's something where it seems like most of the films we've been seeing, you know, lead up to getting married or lead up to falling in love. And this is a relationship that's been many years down the road. And I don't think we get to see that a whole heck of a lot, yet alone with two older. And yes, I'm calling Julianne Moore older, I'm sorry, mm-hmm. but two older ladies.
Right. And I think there is a sense that Annette Bening has been nominated four times. She hasn't won, you know, and for every single one of those other performances, they were great. I think it's her year. I'm going to be rooting for Annette Bening.
That's cool. And I didn't mean to say this was her scent of a woman or The Color of Money, because she's... You know, because you know she is excellent in this, and she also had another backup year with a really small film that not a lot of people, Mother and Child.
That's right.
Which I thought
a
she was strong
movie.
In. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you know, it's her body. You know, so much of these best actors and best actresses, it's the body of work that they're getting that they're getting the win for, and I think I'm hoping that's what she's going to win for.
Do we need to talk about anybody other than Colin Firth in leading actor?
I don't think we do.
Okay.
You know, personally, between you and me, I would vote for James Franco.
Okay.
Partly because it was such a brave, daring role. Colin Firth was wonderful. He's always so soulful. But, you know, with Colin Firth, sometimes I just feel like it's variations of a theme. He's like an old school Hollywood actor who has a type and he plays some version of that type. And with James Franco, it was a really brave, that was a brave role. And he brought so much elan to it. You know, you were down there in that hole with him, and it was it was hard to watch. And he was the reason why that movie worked.
And you mentioned we did the comparison with Portman and Benning. The same thing. I mean, Franklin, this is his first nomination. It's about bloody time. And, you know, he's got a long, long road ahead of him. And, you know, he's going to be he won't stop. He's got things to do, obviously. And I think a lot of people were really rooting for Colin Firth last year, except it was the year of Jeff Bridges. So it seems like it's a lock almost for Firth.
Well, apparently, you know, when you're a younger actor and you want to make a shot at an Oscar, you have to do something that involves dismemberment or disfigurement, or it's like the old sort of getting fat with what you have to do, and now it's like you really have to just tear off a limb.
Well, nobody wants him to turn into Richard Dreyfuss, because he was, 27, I think, when he won Best Actor, and it took a while for him to come back to Earth.
That's right.
All right. Supporting actress.
Now, I feel at a slight disadvantage
okay.
in this because I think many, many, many other people have not seen Animal Kingdom.
Oh, I did.
You did?
That's,
tell me.
Oh, I was really excited that Jackie Weaver got a nomination because it's the scariest performance of the year.
Okay.
It's Angela Lansbury in Manchurian Candidate scary. But I think this is also, I think Hailee Steinfeld, because she's, one, a lot of people are griping, she should have been in the leading actress category. Two, she bounces off everybody on the film with such confidence, and it's such a better written role. Yeah, I'm bringing up the 69 version. And yes, some people have called the film No Country for 14-year-old girls, and she really, really carries a big chunk of this picture.
She rocked that movie, and I completely understand why they put her in Best Supporting Actress. There's no possible way she would have won Best Actress.
Right. See,
strategy.
She can hang out with Meryl Streep and Anthony Hopkins and everybody else in that little category. A footnote is screen time history.
Right. I mean, you know, it's kind of nice. I think that this Oscars says so much for actresses right now of all different generations. We've got two young unknowns, Jennifer Lawrence, so good in Winter's Bone, and Hailee Steinfeld. And, you know, I think it'd be wonderful if Hailee Steinfeld won. She was tremendous.
And it's funny. I seen an interview with her. It had a Fanning-like thing because she used like quite a bit. So I was like, oh, you are a real human being.
Well, the way she wraps her mouth around that language in the script is would lead you to think otherwise, but I'm a little relieved to hear that she actually is a 21st century teenager.
And yeah, both leading and supporting actors, I mean, they're particularly strong this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be a pig and say, I wish all New England barmaids looked like Amy Adams in The Fighter. I'll move on.
Maybe just all barmaids, period.
Well, okay. Yes, okay, best supporting actor. I guess, do we talk about anybody other than Christian Bale?
See, isn't that funny that this is the case with the actors? That, you know, it seems like every Oscar year, there's some big drama that underpins it. And, you know, there was the Avatar versus Hurt Locker, husband versus ex-wife drama.
Right.
And this year, it's all the drama is about the ladies. And the guys, you know, it's a little bit of a yawn, you know? Yeah, it's going to be Christian Bale.
So this means, so I guess Congress should declare this the year of the woman. No, the Academy Awards the
Maybe
year of the woman.
Maybe the year of the actress. Right. Christian Bale, right? Is anyone even talking about anyone else?
No.
You know, and it's such, and you know what's great about this? It's not with both of these categories. It's not that the others aren't fantastic.
No, and I was really happy. Obviously, John Hawkes was probably one of the other bigger surprises for Winter's Bone. But yeah, that's also a solid five.
Right. If you haven't seen Winter's Bone, and you have seen Deadwood. He was in Deadwood. He was really great in that, and it's lovely to see him catapulting out of that the sort of cable ghetto.
Or the that guy status.
Right.
So.
Right. Although Jeffrey Rush, I think, could be a contender for the King's Speech.
Well, they were my favorite screen couple, right up there with The Kids Are All Right.
Jeffrey Rush and Colin Firth?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, are there any, first off, are there any other categories that you want to champion, or any other you know, categories or films? Because, you know, I think this is time of the year where I declare that The Illusionist is this year's Fantastic Mr. Fox. Should win animated feature.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, it should win animated feature, but it won't, because the film that's not going to win Best Picture is going to win Best Animated Feature.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Right, right. But this is like, it's almost like a Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor kind of a thing. Like, do we need to talk about anything but Toy Story 3?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I'm not even going to pretend like I'm going to root for How to Train Your Dragon. I thought it was going to be funny for like 1 second, but it's not. You know, I'm very interested in the best documentary category. I'm fascinated by the fact that the Waiting for Superman is not on that list.
Yeah, I watching that, it seemed like it was kind of a, I call it a no bleep documentary. I think if you hadn't figured out by the time you saw this documentary that the education system is kind of in the trash heap, it kind of reminded me a little bit of Capitalism, a Love Story, and even Inside Job of, wow, tell me something I don't know.
Right. Yeah. No, it's true. I think I was surprised partly because it was the buzzy documentary of last year. And I think it's fair to say that most people, you know, that Gasland, which is a really interesting documentary, is on the list. And that, oil drilling is problematic is also kind of a what the bleep kind of a situation, right? So, I just found it surprising without necessarily saying that the documentary was right or wrong. And also its pedigree, right? David Guggenheim. You'd
right.
think that name alone would guarantee a spot on Best Doc. And I'm kind of relieved that we have a kind of more eclectic offering. And I haven't seen all of them, but I'm so excited to see them all. Have you seen any of them?
I have seen Inside Job, Wasteland, and that's been it. And
okay.
And one of my colleagues picked Exit Through the Gift Shop as the best film of the year. And I think the angle with that is you know, who's going to show up?
Right.
As far as that category, I know if you haven't seen, go to npr.org or the website for Exit Through the Gift Shop, and you hear all about this guy.
Banksy, it's an interesting,
Banksy, yeah.
It's a great doc. But my guess is Restrepo is going to win, partly because the Academy does need to acknowledge that it's aware that there's a war on.
Ah, okay. So that's why the Tillman story didn't get in.
Well, I think the Tillman story was probably just too.
Oops.
Yeah.
Too much. It's kind of. It reminded me of One Day in September, of just an hour and 45 minutes of, man, you really dropped the ball.
Well, and you know, I think that there's too much sort of politics and controversy maybe attached to that. I don't know.
What was your favorite film from last year? And will it reflect what's going to win Best Picture?
Oh, you know, I'm really just sort of thinking about the nominated pictures and.
Okay.
And of those, you know, they're such different movies. I think of the nominated pictures, you know, this is one where I always find myself looking at the screenplays because, you know, it's the skeleton of a movie.
But everybody gripes that the director and picture are not the same. I do that argument with screenplay.
Right. Yeah, really, you say that they're not the same.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, you know, if there's a reason why Titanic didn't get a screenplay nomination, and yet it got everything else. Me crazy.
Yeah. Well, but this is what I'm saying. You know, there's something about the screenplay that's immutable. You know, you can change the director, you can change the actor, but the screenplay is what the movie essentially is. You know,
mm-hmm.
You take away all the window dressing, and you just got that. And if you're just going to sort of talk about the screenplay, you know, I think it would really, you know. We're looking at The Social Network, which I think is going to win for Best Adapted Screenplay.
I agree.
Partly because it's the only thing it's... Well, I don't know. You know what we haven't talked about? We haven't talked about Best Director.
Okay, fair enough.
And I think they've got... I think David Fincher has a shot for The Social Network.
I think so, because I got a feeling that Director and Picture are going to split. I think the fact that Fincher... I'm still yelling at people to watch Zodiac, and the fact that he got nominated for Benjamin Button, which was good, not great, and this is finally a great. Social Network was my top film of last year, and I think if you'd have told me there's a movie about, you know, Ivy League jerks and then Ivy League jerks and lawyers creating a website and then litigating about a website, and it's the most exciting film I saw last year, I'd have said you were crazy. But then there's David Fincher and Aaron Sorkin involved.
Right. And the other thing about David Fincher, why I think he's going to triumph over the Coens, is not just because the Coens already got Best Picture and Best Director for No Country for Old Men, which I actually was not a movie I was that crazy about. But the Social Network represents for David Fincher something else. It's sort of that along with Benjamin Button, a big move out of sort of the unsettling thriller territory and going fully mainstream. You know, he's not going to make Seven again. He's not going to make Fight Club again. He's
Thank
making
goodness.
Disney's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Like, that's where he is. And I think the Academy likes to reward moves like that.
Well, and then, of course, he's got the Dragon Tattoo remake.
Right. Yes. Yeah, he's making some interesting choices. He's making some very mainstreamy choices, and he's only been nominated once before. You know, I think this is kind of his Annette Bening moment. This is his year.
He also doesn't have makeup.
Right. I hope not.
No, he should be all right.
He's like Annette Bening. He looks fine without it. He doesn't need it.
So what are you picking for Best Picture?
Best Picture, True Grit.
Really?
Wow.
Okay.
Okay, you tell me yours, and then I'll tell you.
All right, I think King's Speech.
Why?
It's safe. It's safe, and it's a reassuring story.
Okay, I agree. That's why I think it's not going to get picked. It's predictable. It's a prestige picture. It's a very by-the-numbers BBC costume drama, which isn't to say that I don't eat that kind of stuff up.
Right.
But if True Grit wasn't on the list, I think King's Speech would win. But True Grit, it's epic in the way that King's Speech kind of isn't. There's something very sort of provincial about King's Speech, even though it takes on sort of big issues. It takes place in little rooms. True Grit, it's ranging all over the country. It's epic. It's nostalgic, which the Academy loves. It's American, and it's got big, cool stars who everyone thinks are great, and it's intelligent.
Okay. I might have to call you next week.
We'll see.
That, you deliver that with such conviction. You're one of NPR's, that's why. Now, I don't know what the movie theaters are like in D.C. because it's Indianapolis. We're still getting films trickling down. For instance, you know, in the last couple of weeks, we got The Illusionist and Another Year, which I hope both people get both. Mm. You get a chance to see both if you haven't already. We're getting Barney's version, which I know is up for makeup, but it's also a wonderful film that, unfortunately, I didn't think had a chance in the screenplay adaptation. But it's also possibly Paul Giamatti's best work.
Are you getting out Werewolf too in the makeup category?
The Wolfman? I don't even remember that. No, I know it's Rick Baker, but I don't know. But anyway, this is films that get nominated hopefully get a wider release, and hopefully more people will take advantage of that.
Yes.
So are there any other categories that you want to champion, the Netta Ulaby stamp of approval, whether they have a shot of winning or not?
Well, I'm just gonna put my money on Inception for sound mixing. And I think art direction is actually going to be one of the more interesting categories, and also one where a lot of people will have actually seen the movies. You know, Alice in Wonderland, Inception, Harry Potter, King's Speech, and True Grit. Those are all sumptuous movies to look at. And it's going to be fun to see which one gets the visual nod this year.
I think I'm rooting because I want to see how they handle the score for Inception. If they're smart, they'll just show the scene from South Park where they make fun of Inception and the guy vocalizing the score. And I really hope Roger Deakins finally gets recognized.
I haven't seen that South Park episode, although there was a period after the movie first came out. And this will make sense only to people who've seen the movie.
Right.
My brother would interrupt every conversation by saying,
That's exactly what you could find that particular clip on some internet website, I'm
okay.
Sure. But yeah, we love vocalizing the Inception score. I think all meetings should have the Inception score backing it up. Makes things much more interesting.
If only the kids are all right had a little bit more of a vocalizing score.
Well, if they were really clever, they would have had music by The Who.
Right.
Thank you. So you're having a small get-together on Sunday?
I am. It's going to be small. There are going to be some NPR Arts people there. And
are you going? Is this a come-as-your-favorite Oscar nominee party like I used to have in college?
You know, we're all sort of older, and and we thought about these movies way too much over the past couple years to exert any more effort into doing anything more than chowing down on pizza, watching the movie, and just relaxing.
Okay. And we'll save the Razzies for another year.
I'm going to count on that.
Netta, thank you so much, and hope you have a fun Oscar night.
Matthew, thank you. I hope yours is wonderful as well.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. Tune in to next week's show. It should be fun. It's always fun. It's kind of like Saturday Night Live. The host always says, we have a great show for you. That's what I strive for. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
No. We'll do it live!